was created. These were the stood for two Russian letters that were the beginning of the name of this organization, which in full was the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission for the Struggle Against Counter-Revolution and Sabotage. It was established December 5th. This was essentially a new secret political police. Now, part of its function was to control ordinary hooliganism, which became increasingly common after October, a growing problem with looting, a raiding of liquor stores, rural banditry, and the Cheka was asked to solve this problem. Also, the Cheka was in charge of handling economic crimes, embezzlement, sabotage, some of which were, in fact, anti-Bolshevik, anti-Soviet acts by the rich. But the Cheka also was asked to function, and indeed vigorously did function, as a new political security police, watching everywhere in the country for anti-regime conspiracies and arresting opponents of the new government. In fact, within days of its establishment, the Peter and Paul Fortress, this notorious Russian bastille that held so many political opponents of Tsarism over the last century, was beginning to fill once again, this time with prominent liberals, members of the Constitutional Democratic Party, the Cadet Party, many of whom had been arrested earlier but now were put in the Peter and Paul Fortress under Cheka guardian, SRs, including left SRs when they opposed the government, and many other socialists. Ominously, some Bolshevik leaders advised that this wasn't the worst to come and suggested that Bolsheviks and supporters of the revolution should be prepared for more, as Lev Trotsky, perhaps the most influential leader of the Bolsheviks and the government, besides Lenin, warned in a speech in early December already of 1917, he said, "Not prison, but the guillotine will be ready for our enemies." At the same time, and perhaps more understandable to some, there were also vigorous efforts to centralize control of the economy, which was still declining, and to increase labor discipline. Right after October, large banks and factories were nationalized, declared under control of the state. In December, the first steps to creating a planned economy were announced. A Supreme Council of the National Economy, it was called, was set up to develop a general plan to regulate the economy. In January of 1918, factory committees and trade unions were subordinated to this Central Council of the Economy to create more disciplined labor. And in April of 1918, strict one-person management was restored, sometimes in the person of the former manager or owner of factories. In other words, workers' control, barely before the ink was dry on the proclamation, was being eroded in the name of creating order in the economy, something many also wanted. For many people, though, the most telling, the most shocking example of this rising Bolshevik authoritarianism, even betrayal of the revolution, some would say, was how they handled the long-awaited constituent assembly. Elections to this first truly democratic body, the first elections with truly universal suffrage in Russia, took place in November. They had been planned even before the Bolsheviks came to power, and the Bolsheviks allowed them to go ahead. Dozens of parties competed in this election, ranging from liberal cadets to Bolsheviks and anarchists. And the campaign, the electoral campaign, was impassioned and bitter. Bolsheviks warned against the dangers of letting the bourgeoisie steal the victories of the revolution. Liberals warned it was a, in their words, serious sin against the country to vote for the Bolsheviks, who were nothing more, they said, than power grabbers and murderers and destroyers of freedom. One thing, though, that stands out is when the results rolled in, it was clear that in Russia, socialism was victorious as a political ideal for the future. The Socialist Revolutionary Party, which had massive peasant support, won 44% of the vote. Bolsheviks came in second with 24% of the vote, and in fact had majorities in most industrial regions and in the army. Mensheviks did abysmally with 3%, but still part of this growing socialist majority, and other socialist parties, of which there were quite a few, also won 3%. In other words, socialists of various stripes won 3/4 of the total vote in this freest of elections. One should add, nationalist parties also did quite well. Muslim parties, Armenian, German, Jewish parties won about 8% of the total vote, and many of them were also socialist as well as nationalist parties. By the way, the liberal cadets, who did the best among liberals, polled 5%, less than 5%. Socialism, in other words, clearly won, but the Bolsheviks clearly lost, with only 24% of the national vote. But this was made all the clearer at the opening session of the Constituent Assembly, when a resolution was put forward by the Bolsheviks to support the new government, to support the Council of People's Commissars and the coming to power of the Bolsheviks. It was rejected in a vote on the floor of the Constituent Assembly. Bolsheviks felt they had no choice. They were certainly unwilling to give up power, though that's what they were just asked to do, so they disbanded the Constituent Assembly. Locked the doors, told everybody to leave. This was on January 5th, 1918. They also allowed troops to open fire at pro-Constituent Assembly demonstrators that were gathering on the streets of Petrograd, a firing on people protesting the lack of democracy in the new Russia that reminded many people of the events of January 9th, 1905, only the anniversary of which was coming a few days later. Their public arguments, Bolshevik public arguments about why they closed the Constituent Assembly, are quite telling, indeed quite ominous, in the sort of exaggerated accusations of what they were doing. They said that the Constituent, these are mostly Lenin's words to the public, the Constituent Assembly was really nothing, they said, but a tool of bankers, capitalists, landlords, and others, enemies of the people, quite ignoring the fact that there was a majority of socialists there. According to the Bolsheviks, the Constituent Assembly only paid lip service to popular demands for land and peace and workers' control. Its real aim, Lenin said, was to fasten a noose around the neck of socialist power and the whole revolution. Now, despite these various efforts, perhaps because of these efforts, Bolshevik authority by early 1918 was still really quite insecure. And indeed, predictions of its failure had not stopped and were becoming quite compelling. The objective situation was dire. The economy was, in fact, still declining despite these first efforts, which were still more on paper than in practice. Food was in short supply. Bread was still in short supply. And many, many people were out of work. The war continued. But the Germans, in fact, were quite reluctant to negotiate a peace treaty without insisting on devastating conditions. So negotiations with the Germans continued at Brest-Litovsk, because the city where these negotiations were taking place. The Bolsheviks couldn't just pull out of the war and let the Germans invade it. They needed to create a separate peace. They were finding this difficult. And disorder in the country was, in fact, pervasive. Crime was a growing problem. Looting, hooliganism, they were not bringing order to the country, much less getting Russia out of the war or restoring the economy. And one hears this in the voices of people who are now writing not to the provisional government, not to the leaders of before October, but now writing to the Bolsheviks about what was going on. For example, a group of five peasants wrote a letter to Lenin in early January 1918. And they said, and this is typical of so many of the letters one can find in the archives, being sent to those in authority under the Bolsheviks, and especially to Lenin. They wrote, "It's time to come and take a look at what the unhappy peasant has come to. We reach out piteously to the authorities, and they aren't there. We're surrounded by violence, robbery, killings, bribery. Our babies are already swelling up from hunger and crying, 'Papa, give us some bread.'" The same cry of desperation about conditions could be heard from many hungry workers as well, many of whom, in fact, were giving up on living in the city at all and heading back to their native country homes, where starvation was beginning as well. Meanwhile, alternative parties on the left remained active and were increasingly critical of Bolshevik failures and betrayals. It began to sound like the failures of the provisional government and Bolshevik criticisms. Now, Mensheviks and SRs were standing in that position. And in fact, many ordinary Russians, including many who had supported the October Revolution, were expressing their disappointment and anger. Listen to these words written by a group of workers to the Soviet leaders in early January 1918. "How long are you aggressors going to go on crucifying freedom? You imposters have the nerve to call yourselves a worker-peasant government. You're selling out us. You're betraying us. You're killing off everything holy. You're against popular power. We don't need this kind of socialism. We need order. We need complete freedom of speech and press and the inviolability of the individual. On top of all this, in the spring of 1918, the long-anticipated civil war began as anti-Bolshevik armies began moving against Soviet power. And the dramatic and traumatic events of the civil war is the subject of my next lecture.
Lecture 28, Civil War.
The subject of this lecture is the Civil War, the Russian Civil War of 1918 to 1920. In many ways, this period was a very decisive one for the fate of this new Soviet order. Not only in that this was really the moment when communist rule was truly secured, but in many ways, these years shaped and to some degrees also revealed the nature of communist rule. It was also as contradictory a time as any we've encountered in Russian history, a period full of fantastic dreams of transformation, practical efforts to create a new and better society, and even open utopianism, but also a time of the most horrific cruelty and brutality. Our starting point has to be the war itself, the question of how the Bolsheviks, now calling themselves communists, could possibly have won this battle. The extent of opposition to the Bolsheviks was enormous. The best-known opposition were the so-called White Armies, which began to form in the early part of 1918, organized and led mostly by former Tsarist military officers, all, of course, from upper-class background, together with Cossacks and their leaders. There were three main armies. The first was the Volunteer Army, so-called Volunteer, but in fact, after the middle of 1918, when not enough people signed up, they created a draft. This so-called Volunteer Army, it kept its name anyway, was based in the south, the southern parts of Russia, and led at its height after a series of leadership changes by a general named Anton Denikin. In Siberia, another major army formed. This one led by an admiral from the Tsarist Navy named Alexander Kolchak, though he had to learn how to lead a land army. This was formed in November of 1918. And meanwhile, in the northwest, based largely in Estonia, another army formed, led by another general named Nikolai Yudenich. And there were also a number of smaller armies formed in other areas of the country. And the early successes of these movements was, in fact, quite impressive. Predictions of Bolshevik demise seemed very plausible. By the fall of 1919, white victory really seemed likely to come soon. Denikin's army was moving toward Tula, which was less than 200 miles southwest of Moscow. Yudenich's army had reached the outskirts of Petrograd, though at this point the capital had been moved to Moscow precisely to keep it out of the hands of these moving armies. And Kolchak was nearing Kazan. He had crossed Siberia and crossed the Urals and had reached the major Volga city in central European Russia, Kazan. All sides of the White Army were closing in on Soviet power. Making matters even worse from the point of view of the Bolsheviks, the Whites were not the only forces arrayed against communist power. They also faced organized opposition from a whole variety of parties on the political left. Right-wing socialist revolutionaries, some Mensheviks, and liberal cadets all set up a variety of anti-communist governments in various cities in the late spring, and to some degree had a good deal of popular support in those cities. And indeed, these governments tended to at least loosely ally themselves with the White Armies. They had one common cause, overthrowing the Bolsheviks. In fact, even Bolsheviks' one-time allies, the left wing of the Socialist Revolutionary Party, in the spring of 1918, abandoned support of the Bolsheviks, saw them as too authoritarian, not moving in the right direction, in terms of responding to people's desires, and took up arms against the Bolsheviks and launched an attempted uprising. There were also anti-communist governments, though not necessarily pro-white governments, in the south and the southeast of Russia, established by local Cossacks. In the borderlands as well, the non-Russian borderlands, a variety of independence movements had effectively severed off large parts of the former empire. In addition to Finland and Poland, which were granted independence immediately after the Bolsheviks came to power, other lands as well declared and were allowed their independence. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, all became no longer part of the Russian state, the Russian nation. In addition, much of the western part of what was formerly the Russian Empire was now occupied by German troops as part of the peace treaty signed in March of 1918 at the town of Brest-Litovsk, which allowed Soviet Russia to finally get out of the war and have the Germans agree not to attack and invade, though at the cost of great loss of land, great loss of territory. Finally, as if this weren't all bad enough for the likelihood of Bolshevik survival, they faced the intervention of thousands of troops sent by more than a dozen different nations, the United States, Britain, France, Italy, Japan, Germany, all sent troops to Russia, mainly to support their efforts to move troops and supplies connected to the war, but also many of them turned against the Bolshevik government and were willing to help the White armies. They, in fact, participated very little in the battles of the Civil War, but some of these countries, especially Great Britain and France, gave large amounts of money and weapons to the White armies in the name of overthrowing Bolshevism. Despite all these pressures, the Bolsheviks won the Civil War. By February of 1920, the armies of Yudenich and Kolchak were completely destroyed. And the volunteer army, led by Denikin, the strongest of these armies, was defeated by the end of 1920. As a result, one could say that by the end of that year, the Civil War was all but over, and the Soviet army, known as the Red Army, was victorious. Indeed, this was followed by action to restore, or in many cases install, supportive communist governments in much of the old empire, especially in Ukraine and Georgia. Obvious question, how could they possibly have done this? One answer is that, as the above list of opponents might suggest, one of the reasons the communists survived was the failure of their opponents to form a united and coordinated opposition. There were many of them. They posed a great threat, but they were divided profoundly. They were politically divided. The opposition, even in the organized white armies, ranged from moderate socialists and liberals to extreme monarchists. They were also, very importantly, militarily divided. The white armies lacked any central command structure. By contrast, the communists had one single army, the Red Army, under one single commander, Trotsky. The communists also had certain logistical advantages in waging war. The whites, as I've described, were ranged all around the peripheries of Russia, of the empire. The communists, by contrast, controlled the Russian heartlands. And this also meant they controlled the railways, all of which radiated out of Moscow, now the new capital. And Trotsky very effectively used the railroads in sort of rushing about the country to various front lines, returning to Moscow and going to another front as well. Became critical in success in the war, not to mention in supplying the troops. But there's also other reasons, one of them being that the communists were more effective than the whites in mobilizing resources, restoring order to the economy, and commanding various resources and supplies for the war effort. As I mentioned, almost immediately after the Civil War began, the government nationalized all industry. I had mentioned before large factories and banks. By end of 1918, all industry was now in the hands of the state. Strict labor discipline was enforced. Even forced labor, when necessary, was required to make sure supplies were made available for the Red Army. Food supplies were also assured. Remember how central that was to problems during the war. during the First World War. They ensured that the army had sufficient food, and indeed, as much as possible, that workers in the cities manufacturing for the war had sufficient food by a policy of forced grain requisitions. This was nothing more than sending out groups of communists and workers into the countryside with guns, showing up at harvest time, and demanding that peasants hand over a certain amount of grain, indeed a great deal of grain, at prices set by the government. And if they didn't, they'd be shot. The communists also were very effective at restoring political order over the areas they ruled or conquered as the armies spread. As they had not really done before, only during the Civil War did the government, the Bolshevik government, really set up a functioning state apparatus, part of which, indeed a good deal of which, was made up of soldiers who were believed to be the most disciplined. They also did what they could to control dissent and stifle opposition, and they did so as violently as it seemed to them was necessary. For example, to rid themselves of the threat of a monarchist revival, seen as part of the white effort, to rid themselves of the symbolic center of the potential white movement, in July of 1918, the Bolsheviks executed the former Tsar, his wife, his children, even their personal servants who were with them in exile in a town, Yekaterinburg, in the Ural Mountains. This was a brutal event. It took place in the middle of the night in a basement, and afterwards their bodies were effectively hidden. There's great debate about whether Moscow made this decision and ordered it, or whether this was the initiative of local radicals in Yekaterinburg. Nonetheless, it rid the government, it rid the Red Movement of this threatening central symbol and perhaps leader of the white opposition. But this, the execution of the Romanovs, was just the beginning. Various other members of the royal family were taken out and shot. Indeed, toward the end of 1918, the Cheka launched a nationwide, what was called Red Terror, against all opponents of the regime. Suspected white collaborators, sympathizers, were arrested, usually with the help of the Cheka, and shot, and in general, all members of elite classes were declared to be suspect. In fact, according to official Soviet figures, from 1918 to 1920, in the years of the Civil War, 13,000 people were executed by the Cheka, almost all without trial. Most historians believe the numbers were higher. Some argue they probably were 10 times as high as that 13,000 given by the official government. Thousands were also put in prison. Many were sent to the new prison camp system that was beginning to emerge. And brutality in many ways was part of the style of the time. Torture was not unknown when enemies were captured. And some of this torture was, in fact, brutally symbolic, one might say. As, for example, as stories often were told, when soldiers in the Red Army captured white officers, they would nail their epaulets to their shoulders. Brutality was part of the style of order and suppression and victory. Of course, it's worth saying that this ruthlessness could have easily worked against the communists, but fortunately for them, the whites were scarcely less ruthless. They also requisitioned grain by force, though people who have studied it find out they were less effective at doing it. They were less efficient, less systematic. They also, the whites also used terror, and they also used torture against people they found might sympathize with the red side. And indeed, there were reports as well of white atrocities equivalent to the red atrocities. Rape was often apparently used by the white army, and even occasionally the crucifixion of suspected communists in public squares. And all of this brings me to the most important point, to what perhaps is the most decisive difference between the Reds and the Whites. Though note, this is a scholar's interpretation. Ultimately, and it has been argued this most often, the communists won, not only because they were the most organized and disciplined and had the center and could be most brutal, but because they had ultimately more natural support among the majority of the population, most importantly among the peasants, who were, after all, the rank and file of both armies, the Reds and the Whites, mostly draftees. Partly, of course, the Bolsheviks simply did, in terms of getting this popular support, a better job at getting their message across, as to what Bolshevik power represented. They had, of course, many years of experience in spreading their message with newspapers and leaflets and word of mouth. They were good agitators, and they began to use new means, motion pictures, very simple and dramatic posters to convey the meaning of their cause. In fact, they had a whole branch of government devoted to convincing the people that their cause was the most just cause. It was called the Department of Agitation and Propaganda. But obviously more important than the medium of Bolshevik propaganda and agitation was their message. On every occasion, the communists repeated the same simple arguments, verbally, visually, and indeed in policies such as their land reform policies. They kept saying it again and again. A white victory would mean nothing but the return of the capitalists and the landowners, supported, they like to say, by international capital, who cared only about extracting more money from Russia and nothing about Russia or Russians. In other words, the old oppressions of the past would return. And unfortunately, the whites helped reinforce this Bolshevik message, partly, of course, by the simple fact as who they were. It was no secret that the leaders of the white armies were mostly former Tsarist officers and large landowners. It was obvious that the foreign interventionary powers coming from capitalist countries, as Russians called them, were indeed on the side of the white army. It all seemed to confirm Bolshevik propaganda. And for good measure, white behavior also reinforced the Bolshevik message. In some places, the victorious white army actually returned land that had been expropriated by peasants for their own use, returned it back to the landlords. And even when they didn't do this, they clearly showed no sympathy for the peasant settlement of the revolution, and they showed a great deal of sympathy for big property owners. In other words, most importantly, the communists won in the critical political arena. They, of course, retained the support of most workers in the cities. We remember from the constituent assembly elections, that's where the Bolsheviks did the best. And in fact, they found workers, working class Russians, to often be enthusiastic fighters in the Red Army. But most importantly, perhaps, they won the at least passive support of the peasantry, of the majority of the population, for whom it might be said the Bolsheviks were simply the lesser of two evils, or maybe, as it's been suggested, the evil they didn't yet know. They knew who the whites were. They knew what the Bolsheviks promised. The Bolsheviks survived this cataclysm of civil war. They held on to power. But in many ways, Bolshevism was profoundly changed, or at least pushed in an already acceptable direction by this experience. Most obviously, the civil war encouraged much greater centralization and authoritarianism than we saw before the Civil War. In the army, for example, no longer was there any talk about an armed working class fighting a heroic guerrilla revolutionary war, the sort of Paris Commune ideal that, in fact, was still favored by many left-wing communists. There was nothing but a traditional standing army made up of peasant draftees. And within the Red Army, all the democratic ideals of 1917 seemed to be dead. Traditional discipline was reinstated. Traditional hierarchy was reinstated. Indeed, many of the officers leading the Red Army were what were described as military experts, which meant that they were officers from the Tsarist army who knew how to command and were back in charge. Although the Bolsheviks appointed political commissars, communists, to keep watch on them to make sure they were loyal. Most did their job. The state itself became increasingly centralized for the purposes of mobilizing the population and the economy for war. Most of the popular, semi-autonomous organizations, the democratic organizations that had played such an important role in 1917, like Soviets and factory committees and Red Army units, in fact, disappeared in the course of the Civil War, or at least became much less important than that of the central government and its growing bureaucracy. More generally, the Civil War led to what some have described as a thoroughgoing militarization of everything about Bolshevik political culture, of the way they thought about rule, the way they thought about their relations to society. Bolsheviks, both older members, and especially the thousands of new members who joined the party during the Civil War, got used to, even one might say enjoyed, an essentially military style of rule. They grew accustomed to ruling by administrative fiat. When they wanted something to happen during the Civil War, they passed an order and it happened. And if people didn't obey, they had them shot. This became part of the style of rule during the Civil War, and it lasted after. They got used to force and violence. They got used to summary justice. However, there was another side of the Civil War experience, something that also became more intense and stronger during the Civil War, and that also became part of this new Bolshevik political culture. Just as the coercive and the violent side of Bolshevism grew during the Civil War, so did the idealistic, the emancipatory, the utopian side of Bolshevism. For example, in the course of the Civil War, there were dramatic attempts to transform personal life, especially the relations between men and women. There was a major effort to realize the ideal of emancipating women, of truly making them equal. This was done through law, in part. Laws were passed declaring the complete equal rights for women during the Civil War. And laws were also passed to try to improve conditions for women. A divorce, which had been very restricted under the old regime due to the rules of the church, was now as easy as could possibly be. In fact, all you had to do to get divorced, according to the new law passed during the Civil War, was write a postcard to your spouse informing them they were no longer married, and that was enough. Abortion, until then completely illegal, banned by the church, became free and completely legal. Indeed, a special branch of the Communist Party was set up, called the Jenotdel, the Women's Department, was formed to encourage women to act more independently, to act like equals. They also tried to educate men. For example, there was a big national campaign in the midst of the Civil War against wife beating, a very common occurrence, especially among workers and peasants in Russia. Communists would even gather in villages or in factories and engage in public rituals known as belt buryings, when men were told to bring you the belts you whip your wife with and we will bury it ceremoniously. This too was part of the Civil War. Some communists, in fact, even sought to take the first steps to abolishing what they described as the oppression of the family, seen as an institution mainly for economic exploitation, not a bond of love. They encouraged in its place what many communists called free love, that intimacy should be a private matter between individuals, not an institutionalized one under law. And to facilitate that, they set up collective childcare arrangements, collective kitchens, and the like. Parallel to these efforts to transform gender relations, to emancipate women, were campaigns to transform everyday life, especially among the lower classes, to emancipate the people from their backwardness, it was said. There were, for example, campaigns against religious beliefs, what were called demystification campaigns, where saints would be dug up from the ground to show peasants how they had rotted, or cases in which a communist would stand in the streets of a village and say, I will show you how I can blaspheme God, who doesn't exist because he won't do anything, calls God all sorts of names, and said, now if God exists, he will strike me dead with lightning, which of course didn't happen. Also, churches were closed, and priests were arrested as well. There was also a massive literacy campaign to emancipate people from their lack of knowledge through their lack of ability to read. There were campaigns against swearing and drinking and fighting, even campaigns to transform trivial customs. For example, communists would go to villages and suggest to peasants that it wasn't good to eat only with a spoon, that a fork and a knife were signs of civilization, all part of transforming the society. And side by side with these practical efforts to create a new world, again, part of what the Civil War also was about, there was also a side of radical imagination of even more sudden changes, more dramatic utopian transformations of the world. And this was seen especially among artists in poetry, in fiction, in art. In fact, many of the most radical avant-garde left-wing, as they were often called, left-wing artists before the revolution joined the communist cause because they believed they were creating this dramatic new liberated world. To illustrate these sorts of visions, I want to describe two proposed public monuments, both characteristically filled with wild visions of unlimited possibility and transformation, both proposed for the new capital and the old capital, Moscow, and both characteristically never built. First was a contribution suggested in September 1918 to Lenin's plans to decorate Soviet cities with big, instructive, monumental sculptures that would express for people the meanings of the revolution. This proposal appeared in a government-published magazine. It was proposed by an artist whose name was Ivan Shadar, who came from a working-class background, but though learned to become a sculptor and now was going to be a grand architect. And he created this huge architectural and sculptural ensemble that was to be called the Monument to the World's Suffering. The suffering, of course, that the revolution would end. To enter this monument, the visitor would first pass through a narrow gate at the base of a huge granite wall, guarded by these enormous female colossi with their heads bowed in sorrow. And these colossi represented creation, courage, wisdom, and eternity. All these big themes are part of this story. You'd walk through this gate into a big courtyard and come across a great pool that was to be called the Pool, the Lake of Tears. Nearby, you'd see a granite slab, and on it lay a handsome dead youth, his face expressing, according to the artist, aloneness in the universe. And near him, a young girl, a statue, frozen in a scream, symbolically protesting the pervasiveness in the world of death. At the far end of this pool, where you would gradually walk toward, would be a large pyramid. And you'd go into the pyramid, and here you'd go down a set of dark stairs toward a doorway that you could see deep within this pyramid. And you'd enter this door, and as you opened it, you'd be surrounded by what the artist called uncommon light. This, he said, is the Chapel of Resurrection. And the walls are covered with beautiful, bright mosaics, and a very shiny stone floor reflects light that came into the room through what was called a special window projector at the top of this great pyramid. Overhead, as you looked up, you'd see an enormous golden cupola and a mosaic on it, which was called Praise of Eternity. And on the walls, according to the artist, written in fiery letters, are the words, "Your dead will come to life, their bodies will stand again." Finally, the visitor exits from this great monument, and the designer says he now feels at peace. His soul, one with eternity and revealed goodness, literally given sight and wisdom. The second monument, designed for this massive campaign of monumental propaganda, expresses a somewhat different spirit, but no less characteristic of the sorts of utopian artistic visions that thrived during the Civil War. In 1919, an artist named Vladimir Tatlin was authorized to construct a massive building in the middle of Moscow to house the headquarters of the new Communist International, the center for the whole worldwide movement to build communism in the world to spread revolution. And it was to be called the Monument to the Third International. The building was enormous. It was to be several hundred feet taller than the Eiffel Tower, by which it was, in fact, partly inspired in its shape and design. Indeed, as this suggests, it was to be the tallest building on the face of the earth, an appropriate monument to the glory of socialism. Its shape is very interesting. It was a spiral iron framework, which supported the body of the building, and inside were a series of stacked rooms, made of glass, a cube with above it a cone, and on top of that a cylinder, all topped by a glass dome. You can see movement, just in my description, can be seen as being expressed in the design itself. Movement was also literal. This building did not just sit there. The entire inner body, these stacked glass rooms, were to revolve. And, for symbolic good measure, they were to revolve in harmony with the natural bodies of the universe. The revolution was nothing less than a cosmic event. The bottom cube would go on its axis very slowly and revolve once a year. The cone above it would evolve once a month. And the top cylinder would revolve once a day. And of course, this wasn't just a piece of art. This was a useful building. It provided meeting space, office space, a communication center. This was to be the physical center for the thousands of communists around the world. In addition to all this, there would be a huge open-air screen outside, the biggest screen ever seen in the world, which would relay the latest news about the great progress of the world revolution. And in cloudy weather, they found an even better screen, and in fact, in Moscow, the weather is often cloudy, they would project these images onto the clouds itself, and the whole city would be able to watch at one time. As all these stories and images may suggest, the Civil War era is essential for understanding this emerging communist order, at least at its first stages, and especially for understanding the complexity, indeed the continuing contradictions of power in Russia, in this case now Soviet power. On the one hand, you see authoritarianism and centralization, brutality, even bloody terror. Side by side with it existed these visions of a new and better world, visions of a transformed individual life as seen in efforts to emancipate women, visions of an almost religious transformation, a resurrecting the whole world out of suffering as seen in Shadr's monument, visions of modern power and vitality and movement as seen in Totlin's great monument. One also can't forget that everyday life often remained outside of all these visions. For huge numbers of Russians, the Civil War meant neither utopian dreams nor, in fact, growing authoritarianism. It meant, above all, terrible persistent poverty, collapsed industry, growing famine, widespread drunkenness, and generally a difficulty of understanding all these new words that were coming from the new leaders. It also meant, though, for many Russians, hope that somehow a new and just and moral world was coming. Overcoming these problems, and indeed realizing these dreams, was the challenges Bolsheviks faced once they won the battles of the Civil War. And that's the subject of the next lecture.
Lecture 29, Paths to Socialism, the 1920s.
The focus of this lecture is the 1920s in Soviet Russia, in fact, in what became known in 1922 as the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or for short, the Soviet Union, a name that partly reflected the reacquisition, often by force, of most of the former Russian Empire. This is a very important time for deciding the fate and the nature of Soviet life and politics. This was a time of heated controversy and debate within the Communist Party itself over precisely what would be the future shape and the nature of Soviet rule in politics, in social life, even in culture. Now, it's not surprising that this was a time of great debate, for in many ways, the 1920s in the Soviet Union was still a time of many alternatives, many choices. It was also a time of great crisis. In fact, this period began at the end of the Civil War with the Bolsheviks victorious, with a time of exceptional crisis. In a word, once the Bolsheviks finally won the battles of the Civil War, they faced the most horrific situation. For one thing, virtual economic breakdown. In fact, one Soviet historian, a communist, writing in 1926, described the breakdown that followed the Civil War as in his words, unparalleled in the entire history of humanity. This was extensive. In the countryside, there were disastrous harvests, partly due to war conditions, battles being fought on fields, but also peasants simply had a reluctance during the final year of the Civil War to plant, figuring there was no one to buy their goods, things were so chaotic and disastrous, and therefore, even when they could plant, they often planted only enough for their own selves and not enough to supply the cities. In some harvests, in fact, there were simply no harvests. Some areas, there were simply no harvests at all. And all of this added up to produce in certain areas of the country terrible famine. Famine made worse by epidemics, cholera and typhus, in particular, leading to as many as 5 million deaths in 1921-22 from famine and disease. In the cities, industry was virtually at a standstill. Trade was virtually non-existent. And in fact, people who lived in the cities who had any ties to the countryside whatsoever, relatives, friends, as many workers certainly did, would simply flee the cities, which became increasingly depopulated, and many described them as looking like wastelands. Once the danger of the whites' return was over, another aspect of the end of the Civil War by 1920, another aspect of this crisis broke out, namely peasants and workers began to express their frustrations and anger with economic conditions that I've been describing, but also over the Bolshevik authoritarianism that I described previously, Bolshevik coercion. Massive peasant rebellions broke out throughout the country. Most commonly, these took the form of simply attacks on these grain requisitioning teams that the Bolsheviks and the Red Army sent out to collect grain for the cities and for the army. These teams were hated, and they were often attacked quite violently, and grain requisitioners often killed. But also, it went beyond this. In certain parts of the country, entire armies formed, some of them known as green armies, to distinguish themselves from both the white army and the red army. These armies took up arms against the Bolsheviks. And their goal was not to restore the old order, to bring back the Tsar, to bring back the old landlord-peasant relations. In fact, many of these armies were led by self-proclaimed socialists or anarchists even. Their goal was to get the government, any government, the white government when it was there, but now the red, the victorious red government, simply out of their lives. Let peasants control their own fate, and please don't bother them with new cultural laws, with grain requisitioning, with anything. Adding to the problem, and for Bolsheviks, as communists, as Marxists, this was even more serious, urban workers too began to protest. 1920-21 was a time of protest meetings, of demonstrations, even of open strikes. The main demands were, of course, food and clothing, for which workers were quite desperate, but also civil rights, greater freedom of the press, for example. And some workers even began to demand the return of the Constituent Assembly and the creation of a broad socialist government, not just a Bolshevik government. Most frightening in many ways for the point of view of the government itself was a rebellion on the Kronstadt naval base. Once a center of Bolshevik lower class radicalism, this base was located very close to the city of Petrograd, just a little ways off the shore. And the demands of these Kronstadt sailors were clear and rather bold, and indeed in many ways echoed what peasants and workers elsewhere were saying. First of all, and above all, the Kronstadt sailors protested Bolshevik authoritarianism, Bolshevik coercion, which you've seen described before. In fact, one of their main slogans was what they called "down with the commissarocracy," the commissar being the term for Bolshevik political officials, and certainly for the leaders, the ministers of the government themselves, mixing commissar and autocracy, "down with the commissarocracy." They demanded an end to a one-party state, though they still insisted that the government should be a socialist one, should exclude the bourgeois parties, but include all the various socialist and anarchist parties representing the people. They called for complete freedom of speech and press for parties representing the people, in other words, for socialist and other leftist groups, excluding the liberal bourgeoisie, but for at least the people's parties, there should be complete freedom. And their economic ideal, like their political one, was also sharply opposed to that of the communist regime, though again, still socialist. Like everybody else, they demanded an end to grain requisitioning in the countryside, but they also argued that all state control of the economy, all state interference in the economy, was against their vision of what the revolution was all about. They demanded a society that was decentralized, that was collectivist, that was entirely free. A continuation in many ways of populist ideas from before the revolution, but many describe these ideas as essentially anarchist. Finally, as if this wasn't bad enough in the crisis that the Bolsheviks, the communists, faced, within the Communist Party itself, various dissident factions began to form with names like the Workers' Opposition or Democratic Centralism. And this reflected the fact that many Bolsheviks themselves were discontented with the authoritarianism they used in society and the authoritarianism in the structure of the party itself and the way party life itself was run. And they believed that dissident voices in the party and dissident voices in society, if workers and peasants were the voices, should be heard. Now, all of these conditions, this horrible crisis, led the party, under the guidance of Vladimir Lenin, to change course, or at least, as it would see to some, it would seem to some, to retreat from the radicalism of the Civil War period. In March of 1921, at the 10th Party Congress, Lenin assessed the situation that the communist regime that Soviet Russia faced rather bluntly. As he put it, "We have failed to convince the broad masses." And indeed, he knew he had failed to convince many in his own party. And the solution he proposed, which was immediately accepted, was a major compromise strategy. On the one hand, repression, wherever needed, to suppress open opposition to protect communist power. The Kronstadt Rebellion was put down by force, enormous force, in fact. 14,000 casualties resulted on both sides, the Red Army side which invaded and the sailors side. Workers' strikes were simply repressed, again, often using army troops, and the leaders of these strikes were arrested. Peasant rebellions were violently crushed until they ended. And within the Communist Party itself, all factions were banned. At the same time, the party embarked on a major program of concessions to popular discontent, a policy that became known, because of the centrality of economics to it, as the New Economic Policy, or simply by its initials, NEP. This meant, first of all, the demand everybody made, an end to forced grain requisitioning. Instead, the party announced there would be a free market in grain. Peasants could grow what they want, sell what they want, and that's how grain would get to the city, not by forced requisitioning, where peasants were told at force of arms to hand grain over at low state prices. They also agreed to denationalize part of industry. You'll recall that during the Civil War, everything became state industry. Now it was decided to reallow small-scale, mostly small-scale, private industry. The government kept control of what they like to call the commanding heights of the economy, big factories, the banking system, foreign trade. But small-scale industry was now legal, and so was private trade, essential in order to get the goods from various producers, private and state, to consumers. The effect of these changes were, in fact, quite impressive. By the mid-1920s, the major cities of Russia and the Soviet Union were well provided with grain and food. People were able to move back in the cities, and famine had certainly ended. There were, in fact, shops everywhere. If you walked through the streets of any of these major cities, a major restoration of the previous life, and these shops were filled with all sorts of consumer goods. There were also cafes, various services. It really began to look like Russia before the war in many ways. And in fact, by 1926, this recovery had been so extensive that the economy had reached pre-war levels, had reached 1913 levels, which is a quite dramatic achievement when you recognize that in 1921, the economy was only at one-fifth of its pre-war level. By 1926, it had reached the same 1913 level. This isn't to say there weren't problems. There were lots of problems. Economically, there was too little capital to invest to expand the economy beyond these pre-war levels. And remember, the purpose of the socialist government here was not to simply equal conditions under the czars, which were considered to be quite poor for the majority, but to build up the economy in a way to lead to a prosperous society, to overcome backwardness. There were also problems with society, at least in the eyes of idealistic communists and their supporters. Workers in the 1920s remained a subordinate class. Real wages were below pre-war levels, even if the economy had restored that level. Unemployment remained a persistent problem. And workers at work itself lacked the sort of authority, the influence over hiring and firing and wages and working conditions that the revolution was supposed to be all about. And this was true whether they worked for private owners or even in state industry itself. In fact, all of this was reflected in a joke that many workers like to say, that the new economic policy, the initials of which are NEP, N-E-P, actually stands for the new exploitation of the proletariat. Housing conditions were also terrible in the cities, especially for urban workers, but indeed for everyone. The homes of the rich had been expropriated, mainly during the Civil War, and subdivided, but the conditions in these what were called communal apartments, where multiple families lived in the old flat of a member of the nobility of the bourgeoisie, were often terrible. A large family was lucky to have one room. Sometimes they had to have only a corner of a room. They all shared the same kitchen, the same bathroom. And the large numbers of peasants who began coming to the city as industry was restored only worsened situations. Crime was rampant in 1920s society, even though the revolution was supposed to end the exploitation, which Marxists said was the cause of crime. Robbery, hooliganism, muggings, murder were rampant. And prostitution, said to be a sign of the exploitation of women, was very widespread in the major cities of Russia. Compounding all this was the fact that there were nearly 1 million homeless children and teenagers in the country, most of them orphaned by the war and especially by the Civil War, who were wandering about Russia and the Soviet Union in the decade after 1917. Some of these also formed criminal gangs. And finally, from the point of view of the communists, it was very troubling to see so much of the old bourgeois culture return. Expensive restaurants only for the rich, cafes, casinos, decadent nightclubs, and the like. As this may suggest, one of the most serious problems in the 1920s was what might be described as a perceptual one. The painful feeling among many communists that NEP, though it restored the economy and prevented the type of dangerous rebellion that was brewing at the end of the Civil War, that NEP was a betrayal of the ideals of the revolution, or at least a temporary and necessary retreat that had to be ended soon. Now, these conditions were background to the huge debates of the 1920s. At issue, of course, was not just how to overcome Russia's backwardness and build socialism, though these were critically and at the center of these debates, but also, especially after Lenin died in 1924, but had already become quite infirm by 1922, who would guide Russia in the future? Who would be its new leader? And two influential individuals defined the outlines of this debate, and indeed competed for deciding which group would be in power. The first was Lev Trotsky, also known as Leon Trotsky, a very important figure, a member of the Politburo, the leading body of the party itself, and a member of the government as Commissar of War, member of the People's Commissariat, the Council of People's Commissars. Trotsky, whose original name was Lev Bronstein, born in 1879 and died in 1940, was a rather unusual Bolshevik given his power. He joined the party only in the middle of 1917. Before that, he had been a Menshevik, and then he had been an independent, forming his own group until he joined the Bolshevik party in July. In fact, as a Menshevik, he once bitterly criticized Lenin. In 1904, he wrote, "Lenin was terribly demagogical, malicious, and he even described him as morally repulsive." Now he was Lenin's closest ally. In fact, as a convert to Bolshevism, he was, as many Bolsheviks themselves would say, among the hardest of the hards. And one sees this especially during the Civil War, when he commanded the Red Army, and during this period, he offered a vigorous defense of the utility and the value of using force, violence, coercion, even terror. Partly he offered a sort of practical argument in favor of terror. In the time